you're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of one's fears and the summit of one's knowledge. You are now traveling through a dimension of imagination. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is one man's examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I share my first impressions, analysis, and overall thoughts on Rod Serling's iconic series one episode at a time. However, in this bonus episode series, I'm reviewing Season 2 of Jordan Peele and Simon Kinberg's Twilight Zone reboot on CBS All Access, hosted by Jordan Peele. You can find more of Anthology as well as full episode archives at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Finally, if you want to support the show and get access to exclusive content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and pledge a minimum of $1 per month for an exclusive RSS feed with content recorded specifically for Patreon supporters. Today on the show, I'll be discussing 8. It's the 6th episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it premiered on June 25th, 2020, along with the rest of Season 2, on CBS All Access. And before I get into my review of the episode, I do want to go over a few notes that I have from previous episodes. Most notably, I missed a ton of Easter eggs from the episode The Who of You in particular. So The Who of You had some Easter eggs I did not catch. So when Mel Rodriguez's character is walking out in the not town square, but like the kind of common area, I guess, he passes by a sign that says on like a piece of cardboard that says "Time Enough at Last." And then he also passes by a couple of girls in Catholic school uniforms. And that's the St. Mary's boarding school from Among the Untrodden later in the season. And then also the sign, this is kind of embarrassing on my part. So the sign outside of the psychic's place in this episode of The Who of You has an eye that's from the Twilight Zone, like the Twilight Zone eye icon on the sign outside of the psychic's place. And I think I noticed it, but I didn't really connect it to the Twilight Zone, which is embarrassing considering that it's in my freaking logo for my podcast. So that was a very interesting and funny oversight on my part. By the way, check out podcastdesigner.com. Zach over there, he does incredible work. He's the person that who put together my logo for the podcast. And I, even 5 years later, 5 years into the show, I could not be happier with my logo design. So check that out if you're in the market for some new podcast logo stuff, podcastdesigner.com. And then finally, the other Easter egg that I missed was in the coffee shop, the Vortex logo is put on, like the Twilight Zone Vortex is put on the top of the latte by the barista. And I just didn't even consider that. And then finally, my other piece of pre-episode notes and everything is that there's some analysis from the episode Downtime that I didn't even consider. And again, I'm kind of embarrassed by it because I didn't consider this. So over at the Twilight Zone podcast, Tom and his guest Brandon for that episode, they pointed out that the reversal of Michelle's excellent customer service skills versus her becoming the unruly customer that customer service has to rein in throughout the rest of the episode, like they brought that up and they talked about it a lot. I really recommend checking out that podcast and that episode. But I didn't even consider that as a reversal of her customer service skills and her being on the other side of a customer service emergency, essentially. So I'm kind of embarrassed by that. So that's all the pre-show stuff that I have. So let me dive into, no pun intended, let me dive into my review of 8. It's been a couple weeks. I'm kind of a little rusty because I haven't set aside time to record these reviews in a couple weeks, but I'm back and I'm excited to complete this series, this season of the show, which is also, before I get into my review, it's also a little distressing that I'm recording this August 12th, the day that the third season of Anthology was supposed to launch, actually, until I had to postpone it because I have delayed releasing these episodes or recording these episodes. But anyway, it's a little disheartening because we haven't gotten a season renewal yet. It hasn't been renewed for season three. I'm really hoping, like, every day whenever I get a notification that the Twilight Zone Twitter page has tweeted something, I'm, like, excited that it's, like, maybe a season three renewal announcement. But it hasn't come to pass yet. Hopefully it gets renewed soon. Hopefully there is a season three, because I'm really proud or really excited at the prospect of future seasons, because I really was impressed with this season of the show. So hopefully that will be a thing that I can report on in a future episode. But for now, let me go ahead and go into my review of 8. As always, this review is going to spoil 8 from the jump. So please, if you haven't seen it, go watch it and then come back and listen to the review. So the plot summary for 8, courtesy of CBS All Access, is: at the outer reaches of the world, a team of scientists discover a new, highly intelligent species, but its existence may endanger more than their research. This episode starred Joel McHale as Orson Rudd. He's known for the show Community, which is where I primarily know him from. He's fantastic in that show. I love that show. He was also in a recent movie that is available on VOD called Becky, which I reviewed in Obsessive Viewer episode 370. He has also appeared in 4 episodes of The X-Files, to kind of bring it into a connection to Glenn Morgan. And then he was also known for his work on E's The Soup, which was a really fun show, kind of skewering the reality show, ridiculous reality show trash TV stuff, but it got just super depressing to watch because it's like, oh, this is what is passing for entertainment. But anyway, he also had a role in the movie The Informant with Matt Damon, and to kind of bring it back to sci-fi anthology television, he made an appearance in 1 episode of the Hulu Rocket Jump series Dimension 404, which I reviewed in a bonus episode series on this very podcast. Co-starring as Yannick is Brandon J. McLaren. He is known primarily for Unreal and Graceland, neither of which I've watched, so unfortunately. Also as Channing is Nadia Hilker. She was in The Walking Dead as Magna. She also appeared in the show The 100, and she was also in the movie Spring, which was directed by Benson and Moorhead, who directed this episode of The Twilight Zone. And then also as Ling is Michelle Ang. She was in High Flying Bird from 2019, and she was also in 2 episodes of Fear the Walking Dead, and she was also in a movie that I thought was just kind of okay in 2016 called Triple Nine, which had a really incredible cast, by the way. And then rounding out the cast is Tim Armstrong as Larry. Now, he provides the lead vocals, and he's the guitarist for the band Rancid. And he was in 1 episode of X-Files in season 10 called Home Again in 2016, which that episode was written and directed by Glenn Morgan. So that's an interesting kind of connection there. But an even more interesting connection that I found is that he produced an anthology show, like web series show, called Rock and Roll Theater, in which he played, he kind of took on the kind of Rod Serling-esque narrator role of it. I couldn't find much on it, but I do have a link to where you can kind of read more about it at thehardtimes.net, but I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But I thought that was an interesting connection. Writer for this episode was Glenn Morgan. This is his 4th writing credit for the show. He previously wrote A Traveler, 6 Degrees of Freedom, and The Blue Scorpion. He's obviously known for his work on The X-Files and Millennium. And he also, wrote Final Destination and Final Destination 3. And directors for this episode were Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. They have directed a few, interesting movies. I haven't seen really much of any of it, but, Available on Netflix right now is The Endless from 2017, which I've heard good things about. They directed it. And they also directed Spring from 2014. And they also directed a segment in VHS Viral in 2014, which VHS Viral, I like the concept of the VHS series of horror anthology movies. But VHS Viral was kind of garbage, in my opinion. I can't remember what segment they directed, but judging from the direction that I've seen in this episode, I would wager to bet that they had one of the more solid ones in VHS Viral, but I don't remember. So, okay. Now, plot summary and talent rundown out of the way, let's get into my review of 8. So, as I usually do, my initial thoughts, before I kind of went through the episode with a more fine-tooth comb, is that I felt like this episode was a little too dependent on dialogue to move the plot forward. Like, the overall concept of the episode was very interesting to me, and it was intriguing enough, but I kind of felt upon that initial viewing that there wasn't enough substance to the episode to really make it stand out for me. It is a monster episode, and there's nothing wrong with that, but honestly, the overall kind of feel of the episode is that it kind of feels more like an Outer Limits episode than a Twilight Zone episode. And not that there's anything wrong with the Outer Limits, but this is the Twilight Zone. Like, I kind of feel like there wasn't much substance there in terms of morals or anything like that. I just kind of felt like it was just a Monster of the Week episode, which, again, it has its place. It's not a bad kind of concept, and it's not a I'm not ragging on that kind of overall concept for an episode of The Twilight Zone. I just feel like this felt more at home in an Outer Limits episode than it did in the Twilight Zone canon. So those were my initial thoughts, and let me go ahead and go into my review of 8. Now, first, before I dig in, I just want to point out that I am very embarrassed, again, because the episode title, 8, I originally took it to mean that it's denoting the 8 scientists that are in the Antarctic lab and everything. It didn't even register with me that it could also have a double meaning to refer to the tentacles on the octopus in the episode, because octopuses have 8 tentacles. So I was embarrassed because it took me a very long time to reach that kind of, conclusion and everything. So this episode opens up and it's interesting because it parallels the 6th episode of season 1 in a few unique ways. The episode 6 of season 1 was 6 Degrees of Freedom, about the spaceship that is kind of on its own after nukes go off, right as it launches. So I'll get back to that. I'll point out the similarities as I progress through this review, but I just want to point out that the first opening scene, is, first of all, the visual effects used to create that opening exterior shot of the Arctic and Antarctic is really cool. Like, it just looks amazing. And again, it reminds me a lot of the launch pad that opened up 6 Degrees of Freedom. And again, that's fitting because this episode feels like it's a blood relative of that episode. Like, they both use Whipple Scientific, which isn't really saying much because everything is Whipple in this series. But the actual set design of 8 is like repurposing the set that they used for 6 Degrees of Freedom. So there is a lot of similarities in just the visual aspects to 6 Degrees of Freedom. But the actual opening of the episode is a voiceover narration from Joel McHale's character, Dr. Rudd. And he identifies himself. He says he's the lead scientist, the Ice Shelf Depletion Investigation and Antarctic New Species Project, which is a mouthful. And so this opening scene kind of establishes the scenario well enough. Like, it's a concise way to bring us into this episode and tell us, like, what they're doing without having to use a lot of time and dialogue, between characters to kind of over explain what's going on. So it's cutting straight to the point. And this use of voiceover narration as kind of an exposition dump reminded me a lot of Danny Boyle's movie Sunshine, which I've championed a lot over the years in this podcast. It reminds me because that movie opens up with Cillian Murphy's character Kappa giving an opening narration, just identifying what the Icarus Project is and what the scientists are. So it's kind of interesting. Like, this episode shares a lot of similarities to that movie to an extent. Like, both include big groups or a sizable group of scientists kind of stranded and on their own and facing an intense situation. So Rudd's opening narration, his voiceover, it is so much information. There's a ton of information dumped in this episode, or in this opening few lines. They're 4 months into a 6-month expedition, and they're studying ice shelf melting and how it's causing migration of deep sea predators searching for food. It's a mouthful. And he kind of mentions that most of these creatures, most of these animals, most of these predators rather, have never been seen by humans. So that's kind of setting the stage in an interesting way. And as he's concluding his report, he looks over at the photo he has of his family next to his computer. And he's kind of tying it together, saying that he has a sense of importance for their mission and saying that it's going to save millions of lives and everything. And as he's saying that, he looks over at Channing across the way, and he sends her a simple text saying, "You okay?" And at this point, this episode is very much going to be, and is starting to now, and is going to be, setting up this red herring that they're having an affair, or that there's something going on between them. And maybe I'm reading into it, but I mean, it definitely felt like, okay, this is leading to them having like some kind of affair and everything. Which I thought was a good misdirect for what they were actually hiding, essentially. And then, so after this scene, as we're being reintroduced to the episode, or we're being brought into the episode, we get a cameo of Mark Silverman doing a voice cameo as Rod Serling, narrating a nature documentary about squids. And honestly, I love it. If you go back and listen to my review of Blurry Man from last year, I said that I hoped that they do a nod to Serling each season. Maybe not to the extent that they did in last season, but I'm just so happy that they did this. Like, Mark Silverman does a really great impression of Rod Serling, and bringing this, the way to bring him back and the way to bring him into this in an homage format is just really good. It's a low key way to pay homage to Serling. And I just really appreciated that, because it's not called attention to or anything. It's just, it's there. It's a nice surprise for fans of the property. And also it refers to a squid or a submarine, I don't know, but called Cthulhu in the documentary. So that's a nice reference to Lovecraft. So we're getting more set up. We're getting set up throughout these first initial scenes. And we see Ling speaking Mandarin, and we see it being translated into English and vice versa on the handheld devices, the phones and everything. Which is a cool piece of tech and everything, and it's obviously important to the plot later on, but I thought that was an interesting kind of, again, economized way to kind of set up pieces for the plot to kind of unravel later in the episode. And then, so as we get some dialogue talking about, oh, I've Casper and so-and-so, I can't remember the other character, they come back from their diving expedition yet. And then we get a cut to the diving hut. Now, in this scene, this is our opening scene before the opening credits and the opening narration. And Casper, the character, is down in the diving hut, and he's attacked in the water. And so this really engaged me in a big way. So I really like the claustrophobia of only being able to see a small circle of the water, essentially. And as Casper's being attacked, the blood spray and the filling of the water with blood is so extreme. Like, it just goes for broke in terms of just violence. And I really like it, though, in that I'm not disparaging it, but it's just, it's so intense. It's really good. And it even goes so far as to spray, the other character, Amy, in the face as Casper is being attacked underwater. And so it sprays Amy's face and also the lighting fixture and then the oxygen tank before actually pulling her into the water. So all of that This is a quick succession of cuts showing the drama unfolding in the diving hut. And what makes it even cooler and more stylized is that all of these shots are intercut with shots of shark attacks from the documentary that's narrated by Mark Silverman as Rod Serling. And I just thought that was a really cool juxtaposition and a really cool way to kind of stylize the violence and everything and introduce us to the violent nature of this episode. And then something like, and then there's the camera technique after Amy's taken underwater and everything, and the kind of the waves in the diving circle start to subside and everything as the creature leaves. It's a really cool, just direct top down overhead shot of the diving circle with blood in the water as the waves are slowing down and everything. And we get that, and then we cut to the light on the right side flickering. The light on the right side flickers as the top down view is on the diving hut. I'm sorry. Or in the diving circle. And so we see the water sloshing around, and it's a really cool shot. But then there's a switch to the light fixture, which is another circle in the center of the screen, if that makes sense. So it goes from one circle object, top down view of the diving circle to cut to, a corresponding shot of a light fixture that is also circular. And it's just, and it's covered in blood and everything. It's just, it's really, an interesting, switch between shots. I really liked it. And we see the blood dripping from the light fixture as well, which is really, appealing and, intense. And that's when we hear the octopus coming out of the diving circle. And there's a slow zoom, first of all, there's a slow zoom into and then around the diving circle at ground level, which builds the suspense and everything and makes us think that the octopus or something is going to come up from the water. But the octopus has already left the water, and we can hear it in the background storing itself in the trunk. And the only thing we see, because we're focused on the diving circle, is the lid closing, thudding close. We see the lid thud close. And this entire sequence is just such an effective opening sequence for this episode. Like, I really like the idea of the predator octopus being smart enough to hunt the humans. I really like that as a concept, but the thing that I kept coming back to, and the thing that I'm wrestling with this review, or that I will be wrestling with this review, I should say, is if the episode works as a whole. So it has this really intriguing hook, this opening sequence that's really, really well done in terms of action and setting the stage for a suspenseful episode, but does it work as a whole? And that's something that I'll wrestle with throughout this review. But for now, I'm going to go ahead and play Jordan Peele's opening narration from 8.
At the bottom of the world, a group of scientists is about to encounter an entity of vast intelligence. What they're about to learn will go further and deeper than anything they hoped to learn. Beyond science, beyond fear, beyond humanity, in the Twilight Zone.
Okay, so yeah, this is a succinct and ominous opening narration. It goes, again, it kind of reminds me of the Six Degrees of Freedom one, but also it's another just kind of good, like, atmosphere building, opening narration. So I like it. And also another cool, like, wardrobe choice in this. He's kind of dressed for the climate with a coat over the suit. I thought that was a nice touch. So I like that. So I like the framing of this kind of post theme music shot. It's a reversal of the slow zoom toward the diving circle from before the narration. So now we're moving into the doorway that Rudd is about to enter from while we have the crate in frame on the right. And that slow zoom toward the door makes it just a tiny bit like subtly suspenseful. Especially with the crate in frame. I thought that it was a really well composed shot. And so Rudd enters and he finds the aftermath of Casper and Amy's demise and calls for the rest of the team to come quick. And I kind of like that, just real quick, that as a show of his authority, like he's the lead scientist of this exposition. And he just says like, hey, everyone get to the diving hut now, and everyone's racing to it. No questions asked. It kind of shows both his authority as the lead scientist and also just their you know, the way that the whole team works together in an interesting way. Although the episode doesn't really do anything with those power dynamics or anything within the group to an extent, but I still like that the characters have, like, these scientists have an effective leader in Rudd for the most part. And as much as I loved Six Degrees of Freedom last season, I do feel like that kind of hierarchy of the astronauts was an aspect of the story that was slightly underutilized. And I think that here in 8, it does a decent job of kind of fulfilling that to an extent in a more subtle way. They probably did it better in Six Degrees of Freedom, now that I'm saying it out loud, to be honest. But, you know, equal parts, pretty solid, I guess. So, and that's a complete contradiction. Sorry. So, the rest of the team arrives, and we learn that Casper, Douglas, and Amy are dead, essentially. And I thought it was interesting that Yannick starts to suit up immediately to find them. And, like, he has this energy that, like this was prime, like, Sunshine in this episode. Like, this felt so much like the movie Sunshine from Danny Boyle that I referenced before. In particular, Yannick in this scene reminded me of Mace in Sunshine, played by Chris Evans. And God, I love Sunshine. But throughout Sunshine, Mace, played by Chris Evans, and Cillian Murphy's Kappa, they butt heads a lot. So he, like, Kappa in Sunshine is the kind of, logical thinker of it. Like, he kind of examines situations and problems and tries to find the best solution, whereas Mace is a pragmatic, just go for the most extreme response to a situation because there's no time to dilly-dally or anything. And here in the scene where Yannick just starts suiting up to find them, that feels so much like it's inspired by, at least to an extent, inspired by Mace in Sunshine. So I like, to the point where I kind of wonder if they drew influence from Sunshine for this episode. I really do. Because it's so similar in my eyes. So Rudd points out that Yannick is the only other trained diver that they have left, so he can't go down there. Again, which is kind of interesting because, one of the reasons why Kappa isn't, in Sunshine, why he doesn't go, on a risky mission, or what isn't intended to go on a risky mission, is because he's the only scientist or the only physicist anyway. And then Rudd also kind of throws away as an afterthought, like, oh, and you're high, so you can't go under there. But Yannick explains the kind of pragmatic approach. He says that the tether is only good for 150 meters. And I just lost my place. So only 150 meters. And that they've already been underwater for way too long anyway. And Rudd, so Rudd and Yannick kind of reach an impasse, and, like Rudd says, we can't go into the water until we find out what happened to them. And Yannick says, how are we going to find out what happened to them without going in the water? And I love that they reach that impasse, and then the crate thuds and sloshes. So Rudd opens it, and then that's when they find the octopus. And I thought this was interesting. So Larry immediately wants to dump it. He wants to dump it back into the ocean and everything. And then Ling speaks up and wants to take it back to the lab. And, like, I don't know, this scene, this reaction kind of seemed a little off to me. Like, Larry is more concerned about the lost scientists, and rightfully so. But dumping it back in the water where their fellow scientists are lost seems just kind of hokey and manufactured. Like we needed a line where someone said something, says something that they need to do that. But I mean, they're part of an expedition to find new, part of their expedition is to, like, discovery of new species and everything. And, like, this thing is in a crate. Like, who's to say that the divers didn't bring it up and then they were attacked later and everything. Like, there's nothing for the characters to track that this octopus was responsible for the missing scientists at all. Like, there's nothing to correlate that with them. So that just seemed a little bit off. So Yannick goes on to explain that they don't have time to argue because the divers are already in danger because they've already lost oxygen. They've been down in the depths of the freezing ocean for longer than for about as long as their tanks would last. And so Rudd tries to explain that it's dangerous to go down there alone. So I think kind of the compromise is that they deploy a camera to see what they can see. And there's low visibility, and I like that as kind of a tension building thing. And so finally, Yannick goes down. Like they are like, okay, Yannick is going to go down, and then Channing and Rudd are going to support him with the camera and everything above ground. And then Ling and Larry are going to take the octopus back to the lab. So they've got a plan. And again, I just really love the shot composition in this episode. I think that that's one of its biggest strengths that this episode has going for it. Cause like Yannick, there's a shot where Yannick is looking over the diving circle in the scuba gear, and it's perfectly framed in the center of the diving circle. And it just looks great and helps with the tension and everything. But it's also intercut with the shot of Ling from inside, like the shot is from the perspective of inside the tank where they're dropping the octopus in. And it's just a really cool shot where Yannick is about to dive in while they're about to put the octopus into the tank. And it's a really cool shot composition and everything. And it's also kind of foreshadowing of Ling being the one to inadvertently free the predator of the episode. But I just really love that shot where Yannick jumps in just as the octopus, cuts back to the octopus being dropped into the tank. I really love the filmmaking and cinematography in this scene and the episode overall. I thought that was really strong. Okay, and so now that Rudd and Channing are alone, they have a little bit of dialogue and everything, and Rudd tells Channing that they need to examine that octopus as soon as possible, and she agrees. And there's this kind of clunky line of exposition where Rudd says, even though Ling is just an observer from the Chinese Antarctic Administration, there's no reason for that line to exist other than to explain to us her purpose in the team. And it just seems a little bit clunky to me. But he mentions how interested she was in the octopus and how that doesn't make sense. And I guess that's fine. That's fine. That kind of gives us this insight into the kind of weird behavior of Ling as a character. But it also adds to the fact that in her first scene, the first line that she says in the episode is to ask Channing if the divers found any species. So it's kind of clear that something's up with Ling, but they're not really that clear about what it is exactly. So it's setting the stage for it, and I kind of like that. But, okay. So I say that, but the episode, it's pretty clear something is up, but the episode itself has kind of thrown so much at us at this point. At this point, we're 9 minutes into a 31-minute episode, and there's so much that's been thrown at us that I didn't really register it as something to follow, like either the conspiratorial aspect of Rudd and Channing or Ling's kind of intense, weird interest in the octopus. Those are threads that I didn't really see as something that I needed to follow, just because I had been thrown so much information throughout this first 9 minutes of an episode. So I kind of thought that was a little bit, I don't know. It's not really a complaint. It's just something that is a lot to take in, essentially. And so Channing suggests in response, as they're having the conversation, she suggests that Ling just cares about the work. And that's when Rudd says, he thinks he knows about us, referring to him and Channing. And at this point, I assume that it was an affair, that he thinks that she knows about him and Channing having some kind of an affair and everything, which is a decent misdirect, but ultimately doesn't make sense in the context of the conversation if you think about it too hard. So, I don't know why she would be more interested in the octopus if she knew about them having an affair, potentially, but I don't know. Like I said, so much information is thrown at us at this point in the episode that it's a nice misdirect to think maybe I need to latch onto this idea of these two people having an affair and everything. So they name the octopus Dee Dee, and I'll talk more about that in trivia, I think. I thought that one of the tanks said that, had the name Wiley on it. I could have sworn I saw that on one of the viewings of it, and even in the trailer, but I couldn't pick it up in any of the subsequent viewings or anything. And it stood out to me because Wiley is also the name of the production designer for the show, Michael Wiley, but I can't find it any subsequent viewing. So I don't know if I just imagined that or what, but the other, I'll kind of peek at the trivia and everything. The, the names of the specimens in the tanks are all correlating to the names of the Ramones. The band. So Channing and Rudd are interrupted as they see something on the monitor. And that's when Yannick comes back to the surface in a big, like, surprise gasping scene where he comes to the surface with Casper's body. And then we cut to an examination of the body, which I thought was really interesting because it's intercut between the perspectives from inside and outside of the octopus's tank. And it kind of gives the sensation that this octopus is learning from their conversation and kind of eavesdropping on their conversation. So, I think Larry or Yannick says that Casper's respirator was ripped off of him, and they kind of reiterate that Doug and Amy are dead and unrecovered. And so Red asks the question, what the hell could have done that? And that's when they all look at the window, which is something that, again, so much stuff is being thrown at us in this episode that I didn't really pick up on this until subsequent viewings, but they hear whales and seals in the distance. And Larry says that the whales and seals know what happened, and then kind of refers back to the octopus and says, and like asks, like, how could the octopus have gotten back in the crate after it killed the three scientists and everything? Which kind of feels like a little bit of a leap, because he mentions, like, because that octopus is smart. And it feels like a leap, but he goes on to explain it well enough. I guess I'm okay with it, but he goes on to say that octopi, don't have bones or skulls or anything, so they can kind of squeeze in and out of compartments and everything. So I guess that's fine, but it's also kind of I guess it's not really a leap to say that the octopus killed the divers, but I don't know. It just kind of seemed like there should have been like one other thing to kind of connect there. So Rudd forms a plan, says that they'll call for backup, call for help when the satellite and internet is back up. So they just need to wait it out. And I really like that as a narrative device. It tracks, like, it makes sense that they would have limited internet connection, of course, because they're in the Antarctic. And I like that as kind of a timed piece of tension. Like, it's possible that they'll be rescued and everything, but they need to wait it out. So I like that. So Ling speaks up and says that the octopus is another new species, and it's why they came down there. So she mentions that they came down there to save a species affected by human behavior, and this could be this species' first encounter with humans. It's like she's defending it, and, like, I don't know. It's an interesting way to bring out the conflict between the scientists in a way that's not too, it's not too heavy-handed or too, hokey by any stretch. But I like how the reaction to this is that Yannick picks up the knife and I just love the way he delivers this line. He walks toward the tank and says, I don't care if this is its first encounter, it'll be its fucking only. And I don't know, he's kind of a hard ass in this episode. Like, this episode kind of paints him as a hard ass person, but the confidence is high enough to make him seem kind of in charge of the situation. And I respect that, from the performance. And just then, like, this was kind of hokey, but just then the octopus sprays water into the light and kind of blows out the light. And I thought that was kind of hokey to an extent. It's kind of, I don't know, it's hard to make an octopus seem super menacing without being kind of silly as a reflection of that. So I don't know. But on the other hand, it's a cool example of seeing the octopus reacting to being threatened. So I don't know. And the episode does some more interesting things with that, but this kind of initial thing that's kind of showing that, okay, yeah, this octopus is smart, is aware of its surroundings and could be a credible threat, even though it is contained fairly securely right now. It's a good kind of diving off point for this menace of the episode and the monster of the episode. So, Rudd's plan continues, and he says to put Casper back in the diving hut and turn the heat off so that they can preserve the body until they can get help in about 3 days. And that's when Rudd tells Larry to fix the lights and to look after the octopus. And Larry's response is that he doesn't want to be in the same room as the octopus. And I really like Tim Armstrong's performance here. Like, I just thought that it was really well done. Like, like he's fighting back about it, but like he's, you know, he doesn't have a choice in the matter and everything. And even Rudd's response to that is like, okay, I hear you, but you know, screw it. You're still stuck here. Like it's not like it's such a, I don't know. It's such a, I don't know, pandering kind of thing. Like I hear you, but you know, there's nothing I can do. I'm only the lead scientist, but whatever. So then we get this really interesting kind of monologue or eloquent dialogue, I should say, from Ling, where she says, 700 million years ago, octopuses and humans were both an underwater flatworm, but evolution took them their way. We know that it did. They don't. Human minds own the world. They can feel human, but they are not. And I feel like that's kind of a good condensing of the main point of this episode. And it's spelled out in such an eloquent piece of writing. I just really like that. So it's asking the question, does humanity deserve to be the top species just because we know that we are dominant? And it also kind of makes you think, or makes us an indirect statement of, or indirect question asking, what right do we have to this world if evolution has selected a different species to be the dominant species? And it's a really interesting kind of, spin to put on this episode. So, yeah. So another cool overhead shot occurs after this scene where there's an overhead shot of the lab while Yannick wheels the gurney with Casper's body, out of the room. And the way these overhead shots offer kind of a symmetry to the visual storytelling, and the way that they usher in the different acts of the story is really well done. Like this one, we can see the cell phone left behind in the lab as the gurney is wheeled away. And I don't know. I just really enjoyed that aspect of it. The cinematography and the composition of the shots and everything is really well done. And credit to the cinematography and to the directors Benson and Moorhead, because they really know how to capture an enclosed space in camera in unique ways. And honestly, it makes me excited to check out more of their work, which I haven't yet, but I will eventually. So, another shot from the perspective of the octopus occurs in which Ling is studying the octopus in the tank, and that was cool. But it's also, then we also get a scene where Rudd is talking secretly to Channing about the octopus. He says, "This is the octopus we've been looking for." So I have a stupid joke. Get you an octopus who can, spray lights or something. I don't know. Anyway, let's just forget I made that joke. So I feel like this is more intriguing than what we've seen before of their kind of secret conspiracy stuff. But also we're halfway through the episode at this point, and it's still just a little too vague for my taste. And like, I don't know, the plot overall is a little slow moving. Like the dialogue has been engaging, but again, we're halfway through the episode and what the episode is really about or the general direction of the episode is still slightly up in the air at this point. And I don't know, it just feels like I kind of want to get the show on the road essentially at this point. So Rudd tells Channing that this is the species that Troxel sent them to find. And okay. So that establishes it's a secret mission so that they can find a species that can help with medical research. I don't know, it's an interesting juxtaposition at the end of the episode because we get in a somewhat altruistic approach to discovering new species on the Troxel side represented by Rudd and Channing, whereas Ling's approach is more, you know, evolving the human species and using it for... it's not really spelled out exactly what they're using it for, but the presumption is that it's for, you know, enhancing human beings and creating a new form of human being. So as they're talking and everything and being kind of conspiratorial and everything, we see Ling overhearing them whispering, and she takes Channing's phone from the lab. And so I want to point out this. So this is, I'm nerding out a little bit. She looks at the two of them talking from across the lab, and like, I have in my notes, because I watched this several times. I have in my notes, holy crap, I just realized that this is probably an homage to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Very, very cool. So, I had mentioned in previous episodes in this review series that there seemed to be a lot of Stanley Kubrick references throughout the season. I didn't see any references in the last couple of episodes, I think. But So I haven't been clocking them as closely as I could. And I also, I tweeted at Wynn Rosenfeld like weeks and weeks ago, asking if this was a thing, but I didn't get a response. But anyway, just this scene was really cool because we see Ling from a distance watching them speak, and it's so reminiscent of a scene in 2001: A Space Odyssey, the scene before the intermission of the movie. So we see in 2001, the two astronauts, Dave Bowman and Frank Poole, have gone into a pod, and they're talking about HAL 9000 being defective and everything, and how they need to shut them down. So they go into the pod so that HAL can't hear them, and they say it, like they test it and everything, and they can't hear them. So the end of that scene is we see from the perspective of HAL. We see him reading their lips, and it's a really powerful scene, because it's showing that they're in danger and they don't know they're in danger, and that he's smarter than he lets on. HAL is. And it's interesting because this is an interesting homage to that, in that Ling is overhears them whispering through the phone and can see them from a distance. I just thought that was an interesting homage, and I'm sure it had to be intentional. So. Then we get a scene of Yannick in the diving hut with Casper's body, and this is another beautifully composed overhead shot, bringing us into another section of the episode. We see Yannick overhead and the body next to the diving circle, and there's still, like, the water is still, like, kind of red and bloody, and I've kind of felt like that was a little similar to Not All Men to an extent, especially, like, the ending of Not All Men in the first season, with the red water when Luke Kirby goes under. So yeah, I don't know. So we get some more kind of like these next couple scenes are kind of inconsequential. Channing and Rudd are writing the email to Troxel Pharmaceuticals. This is really all the detail we get about Troxel as a corporation and everything. So they're Troxel Pharmaceuticals, so that gives us enough information, I guess. And then we see Ling in the bathroom or a bunk room. I couldn't really tell either way. But we get another kind of a running thing throughout this iteration of the Twilight Zone is these circular windows. Like there's just complete, like the windows outside in the bunker are just completely circular. And I don't know if that's just a conscious thing in the set design or if it's more to do with the fact that they have limited sets that they're recycling throughout the series and everything. I don't know. But I just thought that was an interesting kind of running thing within this version of the Twilight Zone. So we get kind of this, I don't know, this conversation or this conflict between Channing and Rudd. Like she sees this whole thing as a threat and says that it isn't what she signed up for. And Rudd tries to explain to her that she's not looking at the big picture. And that's when Channing suggests that they throw the octopus back in the water. And Rudd says no. I don't know. This whole conversation kind of felt a little bit belaboring the point. Essentially, like it seemed designed to get another character on board with dumping it back into the ocean and to show that there's reason for it not to be dumped in the ocean, I guess. I don't know. It just, at this point, we don't know quite how intelligent it is. Like no other scientist has been attacked or anything. So it just kind of seems like it seems kind of like a bit of a reach to have another character advocating for getting rid of the specimen entirely. And then we see Ling listening in on Channing and Rudd's conversation. So that's fine. But so, okay. Then after that, we get Larry working in the lab with his back to the tank. And he plays some music. It's upbeat, kind of catchy, and it's kind of a good contrast to the suspense of the scene. I do want to mention, I don't have it in my notes what the music is, but I think it's like Jamaican ska music, I think. Which is another interesting parallel to Six Degrees of Freedom, because throughout Six Degrees of Freedom, they play that song Family, that's a ska song. And I don't know much about music, but I just thought that was interesting that they have two, like, ska songs in these episodes that are kind of blood relatives to each other, essentially. And so, as Larry's working, he puts a knife beside him for protection, which I thought was a nice touch. Like, he's conscious of it. He's nervous. Like, it kind of gives the scene this nervous energy and sets us up for the suspense that's about to come. So we cut back to Channing and Rudd talking. Channing suggests that they let Yannick or Larry kill the octopus so that they can have plausible deniability. And again, that kind of reminds me of Sunshine, just a little bit. But it also feels a little bit unclear. Like, I wish that there was more, a little more development of Channing's perspective on this. Like, at this point, I was kind of, I don't know, it kind of felt a little confusing to me because I didn't know, is she upset because this octopus has killed three of the scientists already? And that's most likely the case, but I feel like it's not communicated strongly enough. And in fact, like, the loss of three of their scientists seems to be a back burner thing for most of the crew, with the exception of Yannick here in a couple scenes. But I don't know, it just seemed a little bit strange in terms of dialogue. It didn't really connect with me. So at this point, Ling hears the whales calling, which is kind of a reference back to earlier when they listen, when they hear the whales and the seals and everything. And I kind of took that as a warning signal for them, or like the animals in the ocean warning of the octopus in a sense. But also, spoiler, I guess that that's also a reference to an old school Twilight Zone episode that I haven't gotten to yet. I don't know what episode it was, but apparently it's shares a lot with this episode, or this episode bar, or pays homage to it. But I wouldn't know, because the nature of this podcast is I'm going through the Twilight Zone as a first time viewer. So we cut back to Larry working in the lab, and we see the octopus freeing itself from the tank. And I really like the visual effects, like the octopus kind of doing its octopus thing, is really effective. I think that it's all CGI and everything, but it looks real. Like, there's a tactile nature of it that's also a little bit computer generated, to an extent. So I don't know. It just feels like slimy. So then we cut back to, like, it's cutting back and forth between Yannick and Larry at this point. And Yannick is in the diving hut looking over the scene of the crime, essentially. And this is where this is where we get some good, like, this animal has killed people that we know and this must be dealt with, that kind of energy. Like, actually, like, it's a very silent scene with Yannick, which I appreciated, and he's just internalizing this thing, like, okay, this, it doesn't matter what we're here for, this octopus needs to die. Like, it needs to be taken care of. As we're seeing Larry being kind of hunted by this octopus, or about to be, he's like, the octopus is stalking toward Larry, and it's really suspenseful. I really like this section of the episode. So Yannick grabs a knife and leaves the hut. He's intent on killing the octopus, and I like it. Like, at this point in my notes, I retract my back burner comment, because this is good characterization for Yannick. And it fits his character. He's a pragmatic character, much like Mace in Sunshine was, and he's dealing with the situation. He doesn't need anyone's approval or anything, or like running up the flagpole or anything. He's like, he's made a decision, he's going to act on that decision. Yeah, and then to kind of break up that tension, we see Channing looking outside while she and Rudd wait for the satellite to pass. And again, we hear the whales groaning, and it's good for the atmosphere. So Rudd approaches and says, the satellite is up in a few minutes, it's time to go to work. It's fine. Like, some of the dialogue here is a little dry and inconsequential. Like, it doesn't add anything, essentially. So we see Yannick entering the lab, and the octopus is gone. And this is maybe one of my favorite scenes of the episode. So Yannick sees the pipe out of place on the tank, and he goes up to it, and he asks Larry if he's seen this. And that's when he turns to Larry and sees the octopus wrapped around Larry's face, camouflaged. And it's such a cool moment. And we see the tentacles going through Larry's nose and mouth. It is freaking disturbing, like, really intense. I really liked this shot, essentially. Ugh, it grosses me out, and it makes me just uncomfortable and unnerved. And then it goes so much further after that. So Yannick gets gripped by the tentacle, and we get this close-up of the octopus's eye with this, like, kind of murderous intent through, like, a narrow slit in the eye. It's pretty cool. So Yannick stabs at the tentacle, and while the tentacle is disembodied from the octopus, it's still gripping him, which I thought was such a nice touch. It really, really cool. And then that's when the other tentacle latches onto Yannick's face And my God, we get one of the most gruesome scenes I've seen in the Twilight Zone or in TV. Like, it's disgusting. It's just so much gore. Like, I'm curious what other fans of the Twilight Zone have to say about it. Like, did this go too far for fans of the Twilight Zone? Like, is this too much? Because we see the tentacle get pulled off of the face while the suction cups are pulling at the skin, and then the eye just gets pulled out of the eye socket, and it's almost too much. It's too much gore, but it's also really, really cool at the same time. So, just really, really messed up. Like, holy crap. It was intense. And so, needless to say, Yannick is now dead. And while the music is still playing, it's such a nice, like, it kind of feels like almost retro at this point. Like, it, like the music playing, it, here's what it reminds me of. So in the movie Scream 2, one of the characters gets killed, in broad daylight in a van. He gets pulled into a van and is stabbed to death and everything, while these very much 90s dudes in like denim and sneakers are like walking right past the van, and they have a big boom box on their shoulder and they're listening to like Beastie Boys or something. And, I don't know who it was. I think like Cottonmouth Kings or something. I used to be obsessed with Scream, guys. So anyway, the music is playing as the character is getting like gutted in the van. And like, this reminds me of that, because Yannick is dead while the music is still playing and we see the octopus kind of scurrying away. I just really like that. It's kind of a nice like button on the end of that very gruesome scene. So then we get a scene of Ling writing her own email while listening in on Rudd and Channing. And Rudd tells Channing that he'll send the email for a rescue while she alerts Troxel. Like, it just seems over-explaining. Like, this stuff just seems way too over-explaining for what is really menial task work that does have some importance, but it is just so menial. Like, it's just, they're spending so much time having conversations about, like, sending an email, man. Like, it's not that engaging. And even the dialogue, or even the delivery of the dialogue. So when Rudd tells Channing that, her response is, she says that she needs a two-step verification code and she needs her phone. And the energy of the dialogue, like, her delivery of that is so, like, the energy is so freaking low and just so uninteresting that it's like a snooze fest, honestly. Like, a peek behind the curtain, something that I do with these episodes is, like, when I'm working, I will rip the audio of the episodes and make it an MP3 and put it on my phone. I also do that to put the clips in for the episodes, but I'll rip the entire audio into an MP3 for the entire episode. And when I'm working, I'll listen to a couple episodes at once and kind of listen to them over and over. Kind of as prep work for my prep work for the episodes of the podcast. So I'll do that so that, like, I'll think of things in the dialogue that pique my interest. And then when I go back to watch the episode and make notes, I'll incorporate those notes in. So anyway, every time I get to this scene when listening to the episode, it just stops it in its tracks. It's so just dull and lifeless. It didn't do anything for me. So, okay, so Channing, Rudd, and Ling are all setting up emails to send out, and again, it just seems so bland in contrast to the gruesome kill scene that we just had. Like, it's not like the tension has been released and now we're getting back to normal. It's like, it's just a complete 180, and it's not, like, it doesn't feel organic at all. And again, and then also, kind of probably the biggest complaint of this episode and this section of the episode in itself is that we still don't know what Ling's whole motive is. It's being kept secret. Like, her being on her own in this and the language barrier makes her whole arc in this episode just really uninteresting, or it's meant to pique our curiosity, I think, but there's not she doesn't have any other characters to play off of. Like, it is all internal on Ling's part. So any kind of insight into her motivations or what she's there for, or what if she's sabotaging things, or if she's working against the team in another way. The only thing we have to play off of, or the only thing we have to read into her motivations, is her physical performance, like her physical presence and her body language. And it's, there's not enough there. It's nothing against the actress. It's just, there's nothing in the script to really engage us with what Ling's whole motivation is. Like, we know that she's acting against Rudd and Channing, but the show is saving the why of that until the end. And ultimately, it's unsatisfying, because when we get to that end, which I'll talk about here in a minute, but when we get to that end, the script forces us to play catch up on so much stuff. It's like, it doesn't really connect with me. So I'll talk about that in a bit. So Channing goes into the lab to get the phone, and that's when she finds Larry and Yannick, and the panic causes Ling to go to them and everything, right as we reveal that the octopus was right above her in the vent. That was cool. That was pretty cool. A little fun little surprise. And then that's also countered with Channing going into that room where the octopus just was and seeing the vent cover. So it's, I don't know, there's some manufactured suspense there, but after seeing the freaking eye thing, like, it's still kind of on the downgrade in terms of suspension building and tension. So in the lab, Rudd is looking around with Ling, and Rudd says that they are going to kill this thing, and Ling says no. That's when Channing reveals that she heard her phone in Ling's room, and that's when there's so much just exposition dump, or there's so much, like, plot through dialogue here in a bit. So Ling says that they knew about Troxel's interest before they got there, and Channing realizes, and then at that point it breaks away from that, and Channing realizes that the octopus has her phone. So I have in my notes, hacker octopus. Sure. Okay. So the octopus changes a screen to show Ling's email, and it's okay. So the octopus is now pitting the scientists against each other so that it can escape. And I have in my notes here, I'll try to do an impression. Clever girl. So Rudd suggests that Ling is Chinese military, and that's when the octopus shows the genome data and everything. And here's where we get the big dramatic climax of the episode, and unfortunately, it's also the biggest failing of the episode for me, because this big dramatic climax, the thing that this episode has been building toward this entire time, rests almost entirely on dialogue. And I love Joel McHale. I respect him as an actor. He's been in some of my favorite things, but, and I was ecstatic to see him in The Twilight Zone. And I think he does a fine job in this episode, but I felt so bad for him, because in this climax of the episode, he has to navigate a ton of scientific jargon while also carrying the tension of the story solely through his delivery of those lines. So, like, he does well with that. Like, he's done well with what he's given. However, it just feels like it's explaining way too much. Like, he's catching the audience up to what's going on. He's catching the characters up on what's going on. He's theorizing what Ling is up to. Ling is not confirming what's going on, but the octopus is showing that things are going on. It's all just a muddled mess. And it breaks the cardinal rule of storytelling and of screenwriting, is show, don't tell. And we are just being told so much information that is not just exposition, but it's the dramatic crux of the entire episode. Like, the tension that has been building throughout this episode hinges on this just word vomit of scientific jargon and explanation and theorizing that, I think, as talented as Joel McHale is, he was fighting a losing battle, because I don't think there was a way to salvage this ending with that much heavy lifting to do. So I don't know. So anyway, through this very long dialogue scene, we learn that Ling wants to use the octopus to completely change what human beings are, and wants to create a new species, which is very extreme. Like, the reveal through dialogue isn't strong enough for my liking, as I've said before, but it's also, it's too big of a reveal. Like at the same time, like, using, like, that big of a reveal being delivered solely through dialogue is just not, like, it just did not carry the weight that it should have with me. And then it also just leaps over, because we are so crunched for time in this episode, it leaps over so many, it makes so many leaps in the logic of it. So then Rudd kind of ends this long run of dialogue with saying that we'd be able to live in the oceans while controlling the land. And I don't know, that just seemed like, okay, fine. That's a huge leap from what we've seen there. Cause it's all just compartmentalized in this one small section of the episode. But, I will say that when that happens, I do like how the lighting shifts and tints his face blue when he says that. Like, I thought that was a nice touch. Again, the composition and the cinematography and the just general camera work in this episode was really impressive. In the actual concept of the episode, like this, the stuff that we've just seen Joel McHale have to regurgitate through dialogue is a very interesting concept. Like, the ocean is vast. Like, it covers most of the earth, and there is a ton of things and species that are unknown within it. So Ling's position is presumably one that would lead humanity to further dominance of the planet. Like, we have already, we're the dominant species on land. Let's conquer the oceans and everything. And, like, that's intriguing and everything. I just don't like the way it was delivered. It's just, it's too much, like, narrative whiplash throughout this entire last act of the episode. I do like this line of dialogue that Joel McHale as Rudd says. It's solid. He says, "Let's be honest with ourselves. We're both trying to take from this animal what we don't have. That's what human beings do. That's what we've always done." I just think that was really, really cool, like, kind of a nice, like, kind of condensing of the theme once again. Like, it's a kind of a mirror of Ling's scene earlier in the episode, and I appreciate the screenwriting for that. And so, like, then he kind of tries to compromise and says, "I was wrong. We put it back in the sea and we go home." And then Ling shakes her head no and everything. And that's when the octopus attacks Channing, and that was very, like, intense. It was really intense because I thought that she was done for. Like, I thought that she was going to be dead. But what I really, really loved about this was it shows the growth of the octopus's knowledge. So I thought it was really clever that the first thing it goes for after her hand, the first thing that the octopus goes after is her hand that's holding the knife. So it is adapted and learned from its attack on Yannick that cost it one of its tentacles, and it has changed its approach to attacking humans. And I thought that was really clever and kind of subtle in its presentation. I just really like that. So Rudd goes to help. Ling is frozen in place. The octopus drops the phone. I wouldn't say we're on autopilot, but it's kind of rushing up to the end of the episode. So, Ling follows the sounds of the octopus in the lab as it's getting away. And there's just this really cool shot of the octopus swimming to freedom. Just it's in the open ocean and everything. It has escaped. I thought that was really cool. So the screens display the sequence, the genome being modified and everything. And again, Joel McHale has to do so much heavy lifting for the narrative in this. This is probably the most egregious case of Joel McHale having to deliver this dialogue that's over-explaining what's going on. Like, he does a fine job with it, but he can only carry the impact so far. So he explains that the octopus hacked the gene stuff to cause a mutation that it is now sharing and broadcasting to the rest of its kind. So the octopus would now be able to rise up out of the ocean and live on land, creating a world in which humanity will be ended by the murderous octopus. And that's fine. It's fine. It just, there's so much narrative ground to cover in the last, like, 5 to 10 minutes of this episode that it's just so much information that's just being thrown at us that, I mean, if it was presented in a more kind of, maybe not straightforward, but a more, a slower way, or it was developed within the episode, like it was developed instead of being held back, It would have been really cool. It would have been like, it would have been a more satisfying episode, but instead it's so disjointed and they save so much information for the end of the episode that you're playing catch up as the episode is concluding. And it's not a good way to gauge it, I guess. So we get the final shot of the episode is the octopus and the rest of its species in the water. We see endless number of octopuses waiting for it to, for the special email from the octopus with a lost tentacle. I almost said another word there. Definitely not that. With a lost tentacle. And I do want to mention that the score here is really good. Like the music is really great. And I do love that imagery of the injured tentacle as a nice metaphor. Like it's almost like the octopus is saying like, okay, yeah, this is what humans do. I lost one of my tentacles, here, open this link and you can go kill humans with me too. So, I mean, it's a nice, like, visual metaphor, for the kind of impending superiority of, or subjugation of the human race by the octopuses. And yeah, so that's the last scene. We get closing narration from, Jordan Peele. I'm gonna go ahead and play a clip here.
What if our role has always been not to rule this world, but to prime it, to lay the foundation for the true inheritors of the earth? The reign of humankind has come to a close today. Here, in the dark, icy waters of the Twilight Zone.
So I like this closing narration. I like it as kind of a summation of the episode. And I honestly like it better than the episode itself. it's a cool kind of cap on an overall kind of lackluster episode. And I also like the way that Jordan Peele kind of looks out the window to see the glowing water with all of the email attachments opened by the octopuses. I like that. So that's my review of 8. I'm going to go into some trivia for the episode. So obviously first piece of trivia is that it's a redesigned set from 6 Degrees of Freedom, and weird that both this episode and that episode and this one include ska music. As I mentioned before, that Mark Silverman does a voice cameo as Serling. And then also, this is something I thought was interesting. So the base that they're at is called Nibe Station, and that's an Easter egg reference to Christian Nibe, who not only did he direct the episode or direct the movie The Thing from Another World, the original The Thing, essentially. He also directed original Twilight Zone episodes Cavender Is Coming and Showdown with Rance McGrew. So that's pretty cool. And as far as the voice cameo from Serling, played by Mark Silverman, is that the actual words of it are from Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau, like an episode of Undersea World from Jacques Cousteau that Rod Serling did when he was alive. So that's pretty cool. I like that they didn't use that. Like, they didn't use Rod Serling's actual voice. They brought in Mark Silverman for it. I thought that was a nice, because it's an homage. I thought that was pretty interesting. So, all right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Anthology. Thank you guys so much for listening. Let me know what you thought of 8, and I'll be back next time to downturn, I guess. I don't know if that's the word. I don't know. This is my second episode of a podcast I've recorded tonight. Anyway, I've been essentially podcasting for 4 hours at this point. Oh God. Anyway, so, So what was this? Okay. Yeah. So thank you guys so much for listening. Check out Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And next time on the podcast, I'm going to be reviewing A Human Face, a bonus episode of Anthology, which will be episode 7 of the Twilight Zone's second season, available on CBS All Access. Looking forward to that, but I'm more excited for the other two episodes after that, for the two episodes after that. But we'll get into that next time on the podcast. For now, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you, and enjoy!
As far as watching things, man, this whole this whole pandemic has just kind of ruined movies. So
yeah,
I feel like everything that I watch is just like a B movie. Mm. You know, even new ones are just kind of like, I'm not even excited for. I'm like, okay, I'll watch it because it's new. But you know, I've gotten into a couple of shows. I've been watching Peaky Blinders on some recommendations from some people, and I enjoyed that a lot. I watched a show called Letterkenny, which was a great sitcom show out of Canada. It was hilarious, but as far as movies are concerned, you know, I watch my collection at home, but as far as new movies, it's just, just nothing I'm excited for anymore.
Yeah. That's a bummer. I totally get what you mean, though, and especially with, like, obviously we've talked a lot about, like, lack of movie theaters and everything, so that's kind of a big issue, too.
So, like, Anthology is edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For a full archive of our episodes, go to anthologypod.com/archive. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. And follow the show on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod. If you enjoy the show, please take a couple minutes to leave us a rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. This is the easiest way to support what we do, and all it costs is a little bit of your time. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation at anthologypod.com/donate, or support us on Patreon for recurring donations and access to commentary tracks and B-roll audio recorded exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Every donation goes toward paying the fees to keep the podcast running and is greatly appreciated. Official Anthology merch, including shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more, can be found in The Obsessive Viewer's TeePublic store. You can find a link to the store in the show notes of this episode and at anthologypod.com/donate. Or you can simply search for Obsessive Viewer at teepublic.com. For information about The Obsessive Viewer's annual live event showcasing short horror films from local filmmakers, check out shocktoberinirvington.com. And for an archive of all our events, as well as news about potential future events, head over to obsessiveviewer.com/live. For more podcast content, you can find our flagship movie and TV review and discussion show, The Obsessive Viewer Podcast, at obsessiveviewer.com, and on Twitter at obsessiveviewer. You can also find Tower Junkies, a podcast where Matt and co-host Tiny share their love of all things Stephen King and his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, over at towerjunkiespod.com and at towerjunkiespod on Twitter. And finally, check out The Secular Perspective, Tiny's side project podcast, which tackles current events and life's big questions from the perspective of secular hosts Chad and Amanda at thesecularperspective.com. Bumper music for this podcast comes courtesy of As Good As It Gets, which can be found at facebook.com/asgoodasitgetsband. You can also find As Good As It Gets music on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Kitty!
Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.